You are listening to a sermon by Bruce Hebert, recorded on Sunday, August 12, 2012, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be back here, as always. Sermon this morning comes out of a background that I'm going to give you a little bit. Langley Mennonite Fellowship. We've been working on an economics study series now for, we started in February, and it'll probably pick up again in September. We had a lovely, or maybe not so lovely, experience back in December where we experienced our own Occupy movement as the young people occupied the church. And they did. They really did. It was extraordinarily disruptive and very economically directed. And then the question became, well, hang on here. Just what are we talking about economically? How do we approach the issue of economics as Christians? Because we were really, to be honest, sitting there middle class and complacent as anything. And the young people really did wake us up. And so we started looking at things. And have subsequently had a Sunday school series, adult Sunday school series, going that has been exploring a wide range of economic issues and probably will continue for two or three years more because there are a lot of those kinds of issues. Well, and then I was asked to preach on Ascension Sunday and was given the Acts text, and I realized there is a powerful economic connection there that we don't normally see. It's really deep, and it connects things together in a fascinating way. And in fact, I think Luke's economics become the heart of why the Ascension story is the way it is. And so we're going to explore that intersection this morning in a sermon that is going to demand some thought, is probably thought-provoking. I'm told it's not the type of sermon you want to preach if you want to have a mass audience of thousands of people come attending every Sunday. You're not supposed to make people do this kind of thinking, but we're going to try. So it's a little bit complex. Listen carefully, and then we can discuss later. So what I'm going to try and do is solve a challenging problem. The problem of the ascension narrative in Acts, which we read earlier. In the story, the resurrected Jesus rose up from the earth and vanished into the clouds to wrap up his earthly ministry. I don't know about you, but for the most part, this is a serious problem story for us moderns. We don't believe it. It doesn't fit our cosmology. All that happens when you go up into the sky is that it gets cold, and then you run out of air. You don't get to heaven. So this morning I'm going to try and reconstruct why Luke might have written such a story, even if it's not what really happened. And oddly enough, I think it has to do with Luke's dislike of wealthy people. Luke really doesn't like wealthy people. So journey with me and we'll struggle with this intersection and see if that weird miracle story has its roots in Luke's anti-wealth theology. So, okay? With me so far. Or have I said too much already? Did you know that Luke had an anti-wealth theology? It doesn't get regular preach, does it? No, but it's there. No, it really is there. Anyway. So one of the fundamental points of the New Testament is that the crucified Jesus continues to live and is part of God's ongoing work with humanity. It's a central reality upon which Christianity depends. And New Testament writers turn to that subject repeatedly. Now, about half of the places in Scripture that talk about this critical point use a word or a concept like ascended. Yeah. But the other half don't. And I'm going to start with those that don't. So if we look at the ending of the Gospel of John, the morning after the resurrection, Jesus meets the disciples in Galilee, where they had been fishing. And they have breakfast together. And Jesus makes some pronouncements. The end. That's it. It's done. End of the story of Jesus. Or there's a resurrection depiction in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I quote, "He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers and sisters at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me." No ascension. Just appearances. For John and Paul and Matthew, and the shorter ending of Mark, the amazing thing about Jesus is his appearances, not the disappearance. That Jesus is gone is for them the normal condition. We don't need to worry about how he disappeared. But the other half of the tradition talks about the ascension of Jesus, or something like it. In the Philippians account, Paul has God exalting Jesus after the crucifixion. In the longer ending of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is having supper with his disciples, and after he finishes speaking, he was, quote, "taken up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God." Now, hang on. Okay. This is an ascension, no question about it. But what kind of ascension is Mark talking about? It sounds, to be honest, like a metaphor. In Mark, I don't read any indications about Jesus rising up through the ceiling of the building and into the sky. Okay? It's just a way of saying that Jesus is now with God, in a very special place with God, and not among human beings. Taken up into heaven, exalted. I think they're saying the same kind of thing. It's about God's relationship with the resurrected Jesus. If you take a look at all of these characteristics, all of these stories with ascensions or exalting, you find that they seem to be indicating something, again, that we don't, as Mennonites, particularly like, which is that Jesus is now functioning in a kingly role. That this is the language of kingship. Kings are exalted. Kings ascend to their thrones. Kings sit at the right hand of God. It's an awful lot like Psalm 2, which is a psalm of ascension of the king. You know, if you look, read it carefully, Psalm 2, back and forth, you go, is this David or is this Jesus? Is this David or is this Jesus? And you can play it both ways. It's very powerful, both ways. And it's very much an Eastern traditional ascension psalm of the king. Means that ascension in kingly thought is not meant to be literal. It's meant to be metaphoric. It's a figurative reading of the role and significance of the king. So ascension in the Bible can mean a number of things, and rising up in a physical body is only one. Most of the New Testament seems to be referring to this kingly role. All kings ascend. All kings ascend to the divine throne. And so does Jesus. Except for Acts. Acts has a physical body rising up into heaven. It's not a metaphorical telling. So the question I have is, why does Luke take this particular version or this particular take on the resurrection, ascension, end of Jesus' life or life here on earth? Why not stick with the metaphor? Now, that's where we're going to go. We're going to try and answer that question. Why did Luke take that version, that approach in Acts? So I want to get into that by taking a step back, because Luke has two versions of the ascension of Jesus. The other one is in the Gospel. So let's take ourselves to the Gospel version. Listen to it and see if you can hear the differences can follow along in the Acts, which you've got there, and listen to Luke, or the other way around. I'm going to read the Luke version. Luke, in his Gospel, says, "Then Jesus led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. While he was blessing them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy." Lots of differences here. If we start looking at it first, in the Gospel, the story takes place on the evening of the day of the resurrection. Jesus takes the disciples out of the city in a gesture of priestly kingship. He blesses them, and then while blessing them, was carried up into heaven. Actually, it sounds an awful lot like the narrative in Mark. It really fits very closely. And it would work as a clear narrative of, clear metaphor rather, of Jesus' new role in God's plan, the kingly ascension. Or maybe not, because it isn't that clear that Luke is really speaking metaphorically. It kind of sits on the boundary, somewhere in between. It has images of the body, and yet it doesn't. And what is going on there? It's somewhat ambiguous whether or not what kind of resurrection this, or what kind of ascension this is. So that's the simple version in Luke. Now, if we shift to his version in Acts, then there are some significant differences. It's not the evening of the resurrection. It takes place 40 days later. And the location is no longer Bethany, but the Mount of Olives. And there, as they were watching, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. While he was going, and while they were gazing up toward heaven, suddenly two men in white robes stood by them. They said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up toward heaven? This Jesus will come again in the same way as you saw him go." Wow. It's a different story. Much clearer depiction. And obviously a bodily ascension. This is a body going up right into the clouds, or taken up by a cloud. You can practically put yourself in the sandals of the disciples. You can be there, see what they saw. Actually, there's a whole sermon there, actually, about the Roman Christians too, but I won't get into Luke's story to the Romans that he's trying to get at. But so simple question, why is Acts so different from Luke? Why is an ambiguous, possibly metaphorical ascension turned into a stunning act of physical elevation? I think the solution to the question comes from a problem in Luke's Gospel. And I think the solution to that problem is Bethany, the town of Bethany. See, I believe that Luke wanted his ministry of Jesus, the life of Jesus, to end in Bethany for ethical, theological reasons. He just didn't write it that well. His intent in the Gospel was to get Jesus and the disciples out of Jerusalem and into Bethany. And he didn't worry about all the fuzzy stuff about what happened then. That wasn't the point, because the point was just to get them out of Jerusalem and into, or actually not into Bethany, but into the neighborhood, the vicinity of Bethany, the fields outside of Bethany. But it didn't work. And in the miracle-crazed world of the Roman Empire, and it was, this is a world where miracles were proclaimed on every street corner, and they were a vital part of the life of the church. Well, in that miracle-crazed Roman Empire, I suspect that the Gospel version didn't go over that well. People had questions. Why Bethany? It really is a good question. Where were the angels? All good miracles have an angel or two in attendance. It's just that's the way those stories are told. And then, what about the timing? James and Paul saw Jesus sometime later. So if you've got... Okay, this doesn't quite work. And what exactly did the disciples see? Let's get rid of the ambiguity. Let's get some clarity. Let's tell the story with some real excitement and some energy. And so years after the Gospel of Luke, when Luke settles down to write the book of Acts, he probably she, decided to answer those questions in a, I would argue, well-meaning way. And maybe by this point, Luke had even kind of changed his or her own perspective on exactly what had happened. Perhaps even forgotten why Bethany was chosen in the first place. And since Bethany is on the Mount of Olives, he simply shifted the scene a little to fit the Roman religious imagination, because gods come and go from mountains, not from villages. Of course, he filled in the rest of the details. So my solution to the problem of why there's a bodily ascension in Acts is an all-too-human story, on Luke's part, of wanting to do one thing, and then over time, letting it become something else. Because that's what the audience wanted. Those are the questions they asked. Those are where they took him. Luke did not start out to write a bodily ascension. Luke started out with a desire to get the risen Jesus to Bethany in order to end the earthly ministry there. Then the fuzzy stuff of a not that well-told story just allowed the audience to start seeing so much more. More that they wanted. More that they needed. And there were some facts that didn't add up. So give it a few years, make a few changes, tidy it up a little, and you end up with a glorious, divine ascension that solves all the problems. Except for us, then it causes real problems. Anyway, well, you get your problems. Possible? Conceivable? Certainly conceivable. Possible? Anyway. The question then, if my construal of this is correct, is why Bethany in the first place? Because that's the critical point. Why did Jesus need to be in Bethany to end the story? Why is that where Luke decides? And he's the only one, only gospel, that has Luke is the only gospel that has Jesus out there at Bethany at the end of the story. So there must have been something about Bethany that made it important to Luke when he wrote his gospel. But maybe something not so important when he wrote Acts. Why did he want to get Jesus out to Bethany? Okay. I think there's an answer, but it's a complicated one. Has it been complicated enough? There's more complication. Okay. You have to understand Luke's theology of wealth and his theology of poverty. They're quite linked. Luke believes the gospel is about good news for the poor and woe to the rich. Luke has no qualms about a Jesus who preaches health and well-being to the poor and calls the rich to give all their money away. And he means it quite literally, give all your money away. It's economically consistent. So throughout the gospel, in ways both subtle and blatant, Luke makes the point that the rich are the bad guys and the poor are blessed. Real poor, financially poor, not poor in spirit. That's Matthew. Actual poor people, downtown East Side people, they're the blessed ones in Luke's gospel. Now, it doesn't tell us anything about Bethany, but it sets us up for why Bethany may be important. So here's why I think Bethany. Four reasons. One, there's the geography of Bethany. Bethany is in the hill country to the east of Jerusalem, about 2 kilometers outside the city. Hill country east of Jerusalem. What else do you know about the hill country east of Jerusalem? Well, in Luke's gospel, a lot takes place in the hill country east of Jerusalem. That's where Mary's cousin Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, lives when John the Baptist is born. It's the site of Mary's Magnificat, the announcement of God's upside-down kingdom that overturns the rules of wealthy and the poor. It's also the place that the shepherds came from that attended Jesus' birth. Matthew has kings, Luke has shepherds coming from the hill country east of Jerusalem. So Bethany is in the geography of a socio-political, theological pronouncement of the origins of the gospel of the good news to the poor and the bad news to the wealthy. Poor people who can hear God correctly come from the hill country east of Jerusalem. And that is where the gospel starts. And that's where Bethany is located. Okay. Second, Bethany was a community where Jesus was well known and supported. It's the home of Mary, the prostitute, and Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, the friends of Jesus. It's a village where Jesus had supporters, such as the family that provided the donkey for his Palm Sunday entry to Jerusalem. It's a site that Jesus visited often, site of miracles, pronouncements. So there are very clear connections in the life of Jesus between himself and Bethany. It comes across, when you start looking at that place, as a place of people whom Jesus loved, perhaps even a place that he loved. Third, Bethany was probably a town of poor people. The scholars are guessing, but the name Bethany sounds a lot like the Hebrew words meaning house of the afflicted. The suspicion is that it's a town of economic migrants, a polite way of saying extremely poor people, many of whom were from Galilee. Fourth, Bethany was the site of Jesus' most famous pronouncement regarding poverty. The poor you will always have with you. Now, think of that statement. The poor you will always have with you. What does it mean when Stephen Harper proclaims the poor you will always have with you from a $1,000 a plate village, dinner at the Shaughnessy Club? Right? What does it mean when it's proclaimed by a drug addict on the downtown east side from Oppenheimer Park? Is the saying the same saying? When the rich proclaim the poor you always have with us, what do they say? When the poor proclaim the poor you always have with us, what do they say? For the addict on the downtown east side, it's a saying about solidarity and social compassion, about recognizing the social need of the wealthy to always be concerned about the poor. I'm not sure it's the same thing it would mean for Stephen Harper at the Shaughnessy Club. So when Jesus spoke those words, were they spoken by the wealthy to the wealthy? Or were they from the poor to the world? So what kind of place was Bethany? I think the point that Luke is trying to make in his gospel with the story of the ascension is that the meaning and ministry of Jesus ends where it begins, not in the spiritual center of the universe, which is Jerusalem, not in the economic center of the universe, Rome, but at the tail end of the empire, in the slums of the poor, in the backwaters of nowhere. If so, it's completely fitting as a literary technique, because it closes the gospel exactly where begins. But then that is quite literally a different story. One from an older, more prosperous, more successful preacher. Oh, Luke, if you read Acts carefully, Luke still distrusts the wealthy. But the edge is off. And from a story that once ended in Bethany, we get the miracle of the Mount of Olives. It's no longer the proclamation of the place of the poor in God's kingdom. Now it's the bridge from the life of Jesus to the power of the church. It isn't about a real ascension by a body into heaven, but about the overstatements of a well-intentioned preacher trying to speak the language of his audience. Or maybe not. We shouldn't press too hard to historicize a miracle. Because I want to affirm here that it was indeed a miracle, regardless, bodily ascension or metaphor, disappearance, ascension. The story of Jesus, no matter how told, is a profound readjustment of the rules of the universe itself. The regulations of the cosmos have been overturned. It doesn't really matter what the reality at the time was. The cosmic reality, Jesus has ascended. The universe has changed. Those old laws are over. And always for Luke, it's a miracle from the poor, for the poor, and a stab at the hearts of the wealthy. So don't look up. Ignore the difficulty of the miracle itself and open your wallets. That's what Luke wants. The poor are always with us. The real miracle of the ascension is that an upside-down kingdom is yours today. In God's new kingdom, true worship is to care for the poor. So let us worship God. Amen.